This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. In the 1995 film Hackers, a young Angelina Jolie and babyface Johnny Lee Miller star as members of a dangerous and sexy subculture of wired youth. They're digital rebels dressed in tight leather clothing with the power to take over anything that dares to exist on the internet. Nearly two decades later, hackers are not identifiable by dress, ethnicity, or especially location, but evidence of their presence and power in the digital world is everywhere. E. Gabriella Coleman is an anthropologist at McGill University in Montreal and author of the book Coding Freedom: The Ethics and Aesthetics of Hacking. Her research included living with a tribe of San Francisco hackers for 3 years, and she's with us to talk more about the experience. Gabriella, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
So not all hackers identify the same way. Who were you studying and how did they define themselves?
So the book covers open source software hackers, and these hackers believe in information freedom, but they don't break the law to free information. They've reinvented the law so that the underlying directions of software is freely available.
So what do they do?
They write software such as Linux or Firefox through internet-based projects. And they're computer aficionados, as many hackers are, but other hackers kind of realize their ethics in different ways from open source hackers.
We certainly think of hackers as shadowy, you know, secretive. How did you gain their trust and get into their lair?
So with open source hackers, because they're really committed to access and transparency, they're pretty easy to meet and talk to. You can go to their meetings, you can go online and chat with them, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be open to having an anthropologist be there for a number of years. So I did volunteer at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is like the ACLU for Internet Civil Liberties, got an EFF address, and I certainly think that definitely helped to grease the wheels.
A lot of us have read anthropological studies of a tribe secluded in a concentrated area, you know, in South America or Africa. So I wonder how you anthropologically approach a diverse group that is spread out so far, really across all four corners of the world.
That's right. They're absolutely not, you know, completely bounded. But since many hackers do work in the tech sector as system administrators and programmers and security researchers, it definitely helps to be in big cities like Sydney and San Francisco and São Paulo. And there's sort of high concentrations of them. It is certainly the case when you do research on hackers that are, you know, perhaps breaking the law or pushing the legal envelope, they're a bit harder to access, and a lot of that interaction will happen purely online.
Well, that's something that you've done a lot, and you've been called upon frequently to talk about Anonymous, the group of hackers that have, you know, coordinated attacks on the internet. How were you able to access them?
That was definitely harder than working with open source hackers. The good thing is that they do spend a tremendous amount of time online on internet relay chat, coordinating and talking, and that's where I spent quite a bit of my time talking to them. But I've met far fewer, a lot less of them in person compared to open source hackers.
The hackers that you did study, however, do you do anthropological, do relationships, kinships, sex habits, food habits? Do you break things down like that?
Food, not so much. Definitely when it comes to kinship, I mean, one of the interesting things is actually in these big cities, hackers tend to work together, sometimes live together, marry each other. And so actually sometimes hackers are thought of as being quite, you know, antisocial and loners, but in fact the opposite is true. They interact quite a bit with each other in person and online, so it's a kind of hyper-social realm.
Talk about some of the things you learned about the hacker worldview. Do they feel like they're on a mission?
Some do and some do not, and that's one of the interesting things. You know, some people hack just purely because they like it technically, they see it as a craft, but others absolutely see it as a mission where they are fighting, for instance, intellectual property laws, restrictive copyrights and patents. But one of the interesting things is that despite, you know, you don't need to have a political mission to work together, and so the large open source projects I studied allowed thousands and thousands of people working together, some of who had a strong political mission, others who did not, but the overall political impact still is very strong.
We're opening up the culture of hacking with Gabriella Coleman. She's an anthropologist working at McGill. She's also author of the book Coding Freedom, The Ethics and Aesthetics of Hacking. How did they make a living, Gabriella?
Most of them do work in the tech sector. as system or net administrators, programmers, security researchers. So they tend to be pretty gainfully employed, and the skills they learn at work then are transferred extracurricularly in free software projects or political projects.
I wonder how your academic colleagues feel about hackers as a subject of study.
Well, I think initially, especially when I was a graduate student embarking on this project, there was quite a bit of skepticism. I think people saw that there was a sort of politics to hacking, but was there really a deep cultural world? Perhaps it was just very, very culturally anemic and politically significant. And I, too, shared that skepticism, but I, in fact, encountered something that was historically and culturally quite deep. And then, of course, I think people thought my field work, given that I was going to San Francisco, would be quite easy compared to theirs, and they were going to very remote areas.
Well, have you come away sort of pro-hacker?
You know, definitely I see, well, I'd put it this way. They're having a huge political, geopolitical impact, whether it concerns digital direct action, reformulating intellectual property laws, starting new political parties such as the Pirate Party in Germany. And I think we really need to pay attention to their politics. I think we're at the dawn, and the golden age will come a little bit later on.
That's what I'm curious about, how deeply embedded they are in our society and the way we live now. I mean, if I'm going online and doing anything, do I know, do I experience the benefit or the work of a hacker?
Absolutely, and that's the interesting thing. For example, if you look at like the punk subculture, right, you don't technically need punks to run the internet, right, or write software. But we have millions and millions of people who write software, who maintain our systems, who also have this subcultural identity of being a hacker. And so they're not going to go away. They're not going to go away. And they're the people who are building our technologies, sometimes breaking into our technologies, and rethinking what it means to have privacy and free speech in the internet age.
We mentioned the now antiquated 1995 film Hackers, and it is kind of funny to see how the image has evolved. I mean, in that film, they were all riding around on fast motorcycles in kind of tight unitards. But then we have, you know, the obese guy, what's his name, the Plague from The Girl and the Dragon Tattoo, you know, surrounded by takeout food containers. Any truth to a past or present stereotype of the hacker?
You know, one of the things that I have really come across in my research is that they come in every shape and size, with the exception of probably a gender question. There's many, many more male hackers. But that said, they come from distinct backgrounds. They have different political affiliations and hobbies. It's difficult to kind of typecast them in a certain mold.
You have a whole chapter on the jokes and humor and cleverness of hackers. Any hacker jokes clean enough to share on the radio?
You know, one of the funny things about hacker jokes is that they're so technically coded that it's really difficult to convey them. But I will say this, hacking is often a rearrangement of form, not to accept the given and thinking outside of the box in many ways. And that's what joking is as well. You don't accept, you know, language as it's given to you, so you'll do a pun. And that's one of the reasons why they joke so much. They're quite good at it because of what they do technically.
Have you remained friends with your hacker clan?
Many, absolutely. You know, I think any anthropologist, because they stay for so long, you end up forming some quite deep relationships as well.
E. Gabriella Coleman, I want to thank you for your time today.
You're welcome.
E. Gabriella Coleman, an anthropologist and Wolf Chair in Scientific and Technological Literacy at McGill University. Her new book is called Coding Freedom, The Ethics and Aesthetics of Hacking. It's about her experience spending 3 years studying the tribe of hackers in the San Francisco Bay Area. You can read more about her and her work on her Facebook page. And coming up, another internet phenomenon that could change the face of higher ed. We're going to talk about the power and drawbacks of massive open online courses when Word of Mouth continues.